Testosterone levels seem to naturally decline as men age, but there has been an enormous rise in the amount of testing and treatment of this natural decline in testosterone. Testosterone clinics promise that treatment will restore energy, improve depression, increase libido, and enhance overall well-being. And until now, there has not been any good evidence to support or discredit this practice. But we now have the testosterone trials to shed some light on the correct approach. Let's take a look. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Evidence-Based Medicine podcast, where each week we delve into a landmark clinical study that has shaped what medicine is today. I'm Daniel Aronov, and this week, the T trials, or the testosterone trials. So this set of trials was an evidence-based emergency. If there was a break glass in case emergency research needed button, these trials would have been the result. These trials were like the first taste of water after wandering in the desert for several days. The desert being the lack of evidence on what to do with aging men who have low testosterone. I'm in a metaphor mood today. Or is it a simile? Meh. And the reason why it is such an emergency is that over the past two decades, the rise in testosterone testing and prescribing has been outrageous. In America, the direct-to-consumer advertising about low T is everywhere, on television, radio, magazines, and billboards. Thankfully, we don't allow direct-to-consumer advertising in Australia, but we have still been seeing a huge increase in testosterone prescribing, testing, and even dedicated testosterone clinics. A really great article was published in the Journal of Medical Care in September 2015 by an Australian by the name of David Handelsman, and it was titled "Irrational Exuberance in Testosterone Prescribing: When Will the Bubble Burst?" And this is a great article that goes into the whole testosterone prescribing epidemic. To summarize, he points out that there has been a 100-fold increase in testosterone prescribing over the past three decades. And this is despite the complete lack of any new indications for the drug or any new evidence for the use of testosterone. He comments on a trial that looked through the medical records of 112,000 veterans who had been prescribed testosterone. They found that only 3% of them actually met the laboratory criteria to confirm the diagnosis of low testosterone. And around 13% of them had contraindications to testosterone therapy. I mean, 1.5% of these veterans who were prescribed testosterone therapy had prostate cancer, and 16% never had their testosterone levels tested in the first place. So what's going on? Either doctors really believe in testosterone therapy, or patients are pressuring doctors to prescribe it. The article actually also points a finger at professional society guidelines for being lax and blurring the difference between pathological hypogonadism and age-related hypogonadism, and therefore legitimizing the use of testosterone in age-related decline. In 2014, the FDA made a strong recommendation that, unlike pathological hypogonadism, age-related hypogonadism was not a recognized disease, and testosterone treatment for age-related hypogonadism does not have any proven efficacy or safety. But you can see why patients would be demanding testosterone therapy. Even in Australia, where direct-to-consumer advertising is illegal, the public can still be targeted, like in this direct quote from an Australian testosterone clinic's website. "Imagine how much your friends and loved ones will enjoy your company when you have energy, drive, and enthusiasm again. How will you use the extra energy you have? When you lift your testosterone levels, you can regain your zest for life, look at yourself and be happy with what you see, and have an overall good sense of well-being." Sounds pretty amazing, but is it true? Well, this week we'll discuss the testosterone trials, which is the first high-quality evidence we have on whether treating age-related decline in testosterone is of any benefit. And I want to clarify at this point that I'm not talking about low testosterone due to pathological disorders of the reproductive system. I'm talking about what seems to be age-related hypogonadism. Okay, so this trial is pretty complicated. See, it was actually a series of 7 mini-trials. I mean, like there was one recruitment and one cohort of low-testosterone men, but they were put in different arms of the trial based on what symptoms they were having. They classified each of them as a separate trial. There were 7 in total, 3 of them were published together in one journal article, and the other 4 were published separately, each of them being double-blind and placebo-controlled. The three trials that were published together were classified by the authors as the main trials, and these were called the sexual function trial, the physical function trial, and the vitality trial. They were published in the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 2016, and the title of the article was Effects of Testosterone Treatment in Older Men. And as you can imagine, they compared testosterone versus placebo for sexual function, physical function, and for vitality. The other four trials were published separately in other journals and at different times. These were the anemia trial, the bone trial, the cardiovascular trial, and the cognition trial. They were comparing testosterone treatment versus placebo for all those things: anemia, bone density, cardiovascular risk, and cognition. I hope I haven't lost you. It will make more sense as we get more into it. All right, so let's start with the design of the trial. So they managed to recruit 790 men who finally qualified for the trial. It was only 790 men who met criteria out of 51,085 men who were originally screened. And this is important in terms of how generalizable this is to all the other men with low T. To qualify for the trial, each person had to qualify for at least one of the three main trials. So this is where it gets confusing, but basically, each of the seven trials had their own specific inclusion criteria, but they were all recruited from the same pool of 790 men. But to become one of the 790 eligible men, they had to at least qualify for one of the three main trials. And then if they also met criteria for one of the other trials, they were also included in that trial. So most of these men were in more than one of the seven trials. Did I just give you an aneurysm? I'm sorry. So all the men had to be over 65 years of age, and they all had to have low testosterone. The cutoff was that they had to have less than 275 nanograms per deciliter, which is 9.5 nanomoles per liter for everyone outside of America. And they had to have this on two separate early morning testosterone readings. They excluded anyone with a history of prostate cancer or with high risk of prostate cancer, as determined by a greater than 35% chance of prostate cancer. Now, this was interesting. To determine their risk of prostate cancer, they used a tool called the Prostate Cancer Risk Calculator. And I've never come across this calculator before reading this study, but I had a play online and it basically asks you for your family history and then a whole heap of questions on urinary symptoms before giving you a percentage chance of finding a prostate cancer with further investigations. Not sure how useful the calculator will be in my practice. I don't think the issue with prostate cancer is knowing whether or not the patient will have a high chance of finding prostate cancer. I think the issue is knowing which cancers are going to be harmful and which will never cause any problems. I mean, what is it, 80% of men aged 80 that will have prostate cancer? Okay, so they also excluded those with high cardiovascular risk or previous cardiovascular disease, because there is some evidence that testosterone increases cardiovascular disease, and we'll go into that a little bit later. So these were the main criteria for all of the patients across the seven studies. Then, to be included in a particular study, they had to meet more criteria, and they could be included in as many of the seven studies as possible based on which criteria they met. So, for example, to be included in the sexual function trial, they had to have decreased libido and a partner willing to have intercourse at least twice per month. To be included in the physical function trial, they had to have difficulty walking or climbing stairs, and they had to be slow, with a gait speed of less than 1.2 meters per second on the 6-minute walk test. And to be included in the vitality trial, they had to have low vitality as measured by some functional fatigue scale that I've never heard of before. So if they had low libido and low vitality, they would be included in both the sexual function trial and the low vitality trial. If they had low libido, difficulty walking, and low vitality, they would have been included in all three of these trials. It's a bit confusing, but I hope that makes sense now. So what I'll do is I'll mainly talk about these three studies that were published in the one article in the New England Journal of Medicine. Then I'll briefly go over the results of the other four studies. Okay, so they randomized half of the participants to testosterone and the other half to placebo. The testosterone they used was 1% androgel in a pump bottle, and they initially started with 5 grams topically daily, but they titrated the dose to keep the serum concentration to a normal level. And they considered a normal level as the normal range for someone aged 19 to 40. The cool thing is, to maintain placebo, they also did these fake dose titrations to those getting the placebo gel. So they followed these patients up for 12 months and checked to see how they were doing across the various outcomes at 3, 6, 9, and 12 months. So what did they find? Well, for starters, those that were randomized to the testosterone group did have increased levels of serum testosterone. It quickly went into the middle of the normal range for young men, and they were able to maintain that level for the duration of the trial in basically all of them. All right, so in the interests of time and preventing further aneurysms, I'm going to mention the results of the primary outcome of each of the seven trials. I'll only mention the secondary outcomes if I think it was important. And we talked about the differences between primary and secondary outcomes in episode 6, but briefly, the primary outcome is what the entire trial is designed around. So the trial is designed to answer the questions set by the primary outcome, but it is not designed to answer the questions of the secondary outcomes. There are usually heaps of secondary outcomes, and they are other outcomes that might be interesting. But because the study was not specifically designed to assess these, we have to be cautious when interpreting them. At best, they are for raising new hypotheses rather than answering them. All right, let's start with the vitality trial, because I can't get that quote out of my head. When you lift your testosterone levels, you can regain your zest for life, look at yourself and be happy with what you see, and have an overall sense of well-being. So, out of the 790 men in the overall study, 474 qualified for the vitality trial. And remember, these were men who had to have low vitality, and this was determined by a vitality symptom scale. For those that are interested, the scale they used was called the FACIT Fatigue Scale, which stands for Functional Assessment of Chronic Illness Therapy Fatigue. And it gets patients to give a score out of 5 for 13 different symptoms, like I feel tired, I have trouble starting things because I'm tired, I feel weak all over, I need help doing my usual activities, and things like that. The primary outcome was how many men in each group had a greater than 4-point increase in this vitality score. They chose 4 because that is supposed to be the minimally clinically important difference. So there's statistical significance and there's clinical significance, and they are not the same thing. Clinical significance is at what difference in score would a patient actually notice a difference in their symptoms? So for example, imagine if we were researching a drug for pain and asking people to rate their pain out of 100. If the pain went from an average of 86 out of 100 to an average of 85 out of 100 with the drug, that could well and truly be statistically significant, if there was enough people in this trial, of course. But I think we can all agree that it is not a clinically meaningful difference. No one will notice a difference in pain going from 86 out of 100 to 85. What's more valuable is knowing how many people reached a clinically meaningful change in pain scores, which is usually around 10 for a 100-point scale. So they pre-specified that a difference in 4 points on this FACIT fatigue scale was clinically significant, and they wanted to see how many people in each group reached this 4-point improvement. And I really want to give credit to these authors, because what plagues the medical scientific literature is really bad use of scales. The worst thing you could do is only tell me the average change in the scale. For example, if they only told us that giving testosterone improved the FACIT fatigue scale by 5, whereas placebo improved it by 3, it doesn't help me use this information with my patients. Hey, this drug will improve your vitality by 2 points over placebo on some 65-point scale. That's not useful information, but it's so common that this is all we get from trials. What is much more useful is if they tell us what the minimally important change in the scale is, and then tell us how many patients in each group reach that level. That way, clinicians can use the information to help them and their patients decide if the drug is best for them or not. For example, 6 out of 10 will notice improvement in their vitality with testosterone versus 5 out of 10 who will notice improvement with placebo. So to their credit, this study did that for all of the scales they used across the 7 trials, and there were a lot of scales. Now, I just made those 2 numbers up before, because in fact, there was no difference. The amount of people who reached a minimally important difference in vitality was the same in the testosterone and the placebo groups. So the bottom line for this vitality trial: if an elderly male patient has low testosterone that is not caused by pathology of the reproductive system, and they have low vitality, such as lack of energy, tired all the time, or feeling washed out, restoring their testosterone levels with hormone therapy will not impact on their vitality. Okay, let's go to the second trial, the physical function trial. So 387 patients out of the 790 were enrolled in this trial. The primary outcome was how many people achieved a 50-meter increase in their 6-minute walk test. Again, I love it that they did this. So much better than just telling us how many meters difference there was between the two groups on average. So they assessed how far each patient could walk in 6 minutes and then checked what percentage of men had their 6-minute walk test increased by 50 meters. Was it more in the testosterone group? And drum roll. Actually, I might be able to edit an actual drum roll in after I finish recording. There you go. There was no difference in the number of people who were able to improve their 6-minute walk test between the two groups. Bottom line, for men with low testosterone due to age and poor mobility, such as with difficulty walking or climbing stairs or just being slow walkers, testosterone therapy did not improve their physical function. Now, while that's the bottom line because that was the primary outcome, another complicated thing about this study is while they tested physical function in the 387 men who qualified for the physical function trial, they also did all the surveys for each of the outcomes in all of the other men as well. And when they did the analysis on all 790 patients, there was a statistically significant difference in physical functioning. The number needed to treat was 12. So for every 12 people you treat with testosterone, one more will be able to walk an additional 50 meters in 6 minutes. So make of that what you will. The last of the three main trials was the sexual function trial. Now this trial had 459 patients in it. That's out of the pool of 790. And these patients had to have low testosterone and low libido. And they also had to have a partner willing to engage in intercourse at least twice a month. Now, here's the weird part about this. To determine if someone had low libido, they used one scale called the DISFM-2 scale. So you'd think that the primary outcome would be, you know, the percentage improvement in this scale. But no, it was the improvement in a different scale, the PDQ-Q4 scale. Now, you don't need to know any of these scales. They are not for clinical use, but for research. But come on. Well, in fairness, I dug a little deeper, and the first scale is to determine if someone had low libido, whereas the second scale is to determine how much their sexual function has actually changed, which is reasonable, I guess. But seriously, this study had the most amount of scales I've ever seen in a randomized controlled trial before. I mean, can you imagine being one of the poor men who qualified for all of these trials? Like, having poor vitality, sexual function, and mobility is bad. But is it as bad as having to sit through this ridiculous battery of surveys every 3 months for a year? And I'm just telling you about the scores they used in the primary outcomes. They had like 4 times as many scales and scores in the secondary outcomes. All right, so the baseline score for this PDQ-Q4 scale, or the Psychosexual Daily Questionnaire for those playing at home, was 1.4 out of a possible score of 12. And this score just asked people, did you experience any of the following today? Sexual daydreams, sexual intercourse, flirting, ejaculation. And they had 12 of these yes or no questions that have just forced me to change my rating from a general rating to a mature audience rating. Damn you, PDQ-Q4. So the average baseline score was 1.4 in both groups. It went to an average of 1.3 out of 12 in the placebo group. And in the testosterone group, can I get that drum roll again, please? It went to 1.9, so a 0.6 point increase in this 12-point scale over placebo. So the bottom line for sexual function, getting an elderly male's testosterone levels to that of a young man will give them about half an extra flirt, or half an extra spontaneous erection, or half an extra sexual daydream per day. Can you see why scales can be so hard to interpret? Even with all the great stuff they did and the way they reported their scales, it's still difficult to use this information to tell the patient sitting in front of you what meaningful benefit they can expect from testosterone. You should take this. Well, why, doctor? Well, it will increase your PDQ-Q4 score by 0.5 points. Isn't that awesome? So, what does that mean? Well, it means you might have an extra episode of sexual intercourse every 2 days. Well, that's great. I'll take it. Not so fast. It might just mean you flirt with someone extra every 2 days, or that you get an extra sexual daydream every 2 days. Isn't that awesome? I should also say that the improvement in erectile function was nowhere near as good as the phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors, otherwise known as the Viagra type drugs. So this trial assessed erectile function as a secondary outcome in the sexual function trial. You'll never believe how they assessed erectile function. That's right, another symptom scoring scale. Just what this trial needed. So I won't go into it, but they used a scale called the IIEF erectile function score, which is great because this is the same scale used in the Viagra-type drug trials, so we can compare the difference. So for testosterone, this trial showed it increased the erectile function score by an average of 2.6 points. But in trials of Viagra in the elderly, this score increased by 5.7 points, so at least twice as good. Okay, so that's the primary outcomes for the three main trials out of the way. Now, each of those trials did have a lot of secondary outcomes, and some of them were statistically significant while others weren't. But one of the secondary outcomes I'm a really big fan of, so I'm going to mention it. Now, I love it when trials actually ask the patient, "Did you feel better on this drug?" It's such an easy thing to do, and it can be so much more meaningful than these complicated scales. After all, this is how we assess efficacy in clinical practice. I mean, if you're using PDQ-Q4 questionnaires to assess the response of treatment in your patients, then this outcome tool is for you. But in the real world, clinicians assess whether a drug is working simply by asking them, "Has this symptom of yours improved with this drug?" And this trial did exactly that, which is awesome. They shoved the results in the supplementary appendix, but they did ask all the patients these questions. Since the beginning of the trial, has your sexual desire been better? Not changed or worse? Has your walking ability been better, unchanged or worse? And has your energy been better, unchanged or worse? And here, the results looked a little more promising. With regards to physical functioning, around 11% of those who got placebo said that their walking ability got much better, compared to 18% of those who got testosterone. So an absolute difference of 7% in the patient's impression of their improvement in physical functioning, making a number needed to treat of 15. For vitality, around 10% of those in the placebo group said their energy levels were much better, compared to about 21% in the testosterone group, a number needed to treat of around 10 for patient impression of improvement in vitality. And finally, with regards to sexual function, 5% of those getting placebo said that their sexual desire was much better, compared to 20% of those who got testosterone. The NNT there is 7. So for every 7 patients with low testosterone and low libido who are treated with testosterone therapy, 1 will report an improvement in sexual function. So the bottom line for these three main T trials is, for elderly men who have low testosterone levels that is not due to pathology of the reproductive system, restoring these levels to that of a young man with testosterone therapy will not improve objective measures of vitality or physical functioning, but will result in a slight improvement in objective measures of sexual functioning, which is of marginal clinical significance and is likely inferior to Viagra. But there will be subjective improvements in sexual function, vitality, and physical function in about 10% of patients. There, I think that's a nice little summary I can use with patients. So about 1 in 10 patients who get testosterone therapy will feel much better in terms of sexual functioning, energy levels, and physical functioning compared to placebo. Alright, has anyone else got a headache? I've got a headache. But we still have 4 more of these T trials to get through. Okay, let's brush over them quickly. So, to recap, in case I lost you when I talked about that first symptom scale, so many scales ago, the T trials involved 7 trials using a pool of 790 patients assessing the impact of testosterone therapy on 7 different outcomes. The main 3 were vitality, physical function, and sexual function. They were covered in 1 article in the New England Journal of Medicine, and we just went over their results. Okay, so let's do the cardiovascular trial next. So this trial was published as a separate publication in JAMA in February 2017. And all of these studies will be linked in the show notes at www.ebmpodcast.com. Now, this trial wanted to assess whether testosterone therapy increased cardiovascular disease. And this is because there is some evidence that testosterone therapy does. There have been several cohort studies that have shown this and 1 randomized control trial. The randomized control trial is interesting because despite having a very small number of people in the study, 10 people in the testosterone group developed an adverse cardiac event versus only 1 in the placebo group. Now, these were patients who were at much higher risk than the patients in our study. So you can't really assess cardiovascular disease with only 790 low-risk patients over 1 year. because cardiovascular disease events are rare. So you need a lot more people with higher risk followed for a lot longer. So what they did instead of using cardiovascular disease was they used a surrogate marker, which was an increase in non-calcified coronary artery plaque volume and coronary artery calcification score. So 170 men were enrolled in this part of the trial, and they put them into a CT coronary angiogram machine at the start of the study and at the end of the study to see who had more atherosclerotic plaque buildup in their coronary arteries. And this was worse in the testosterone group. There was a greater increase in coronary artery plaque buildup with testosterone therapy versus placebo. So look, who knows if that means more heart attacks? But put in the context of the other trials that have shown increased cardiovascular disease with testosterone therapy, I think we should be cautious. All right, the cognition trial was published in JAMA in February 2017. 493 of the 790 men met criteria for age-associated memory impairment, and there was no improvement in cognitive function or memory with testosterone. Let's go straight to the anemia trial. This was published in JAMA Internal Medicine in April of 2017. Here they found 126 patients out of the cohort of 790 who were anemic, and half of them had no known cause. The primary outcome was how many people achieved a rise in hemoglobin by 1 gram per deciliter. 54% of men did this when given testosterone versus 15% who were given placebo. So treating low testosterone in anemic patients with testosterone will improve anemia with a number needed to treat of 3. And finally, the bone trial. So this was published in the same issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, and here they took 211 patients and checked whether their volumetric bone mineral density changed using quantitative CT scanning. But they also checked bone mineral density with normal DEXA scanning. And there was a slight increase in bone mineral density with testosterone therapy. But what we really care about is fractures, right? And they did check for fractures at regular intervals in all the 790 participants. During the 12 months of the study, 6 got a fracture in the testosterone group and 6 got a fracture in the placebo group. That probably warranted a drum roll. Too late. Okay, I'll finish off by saying that there was no difference in adverse events between the testosterone and placebo groups. But again, the main adverse effect we fear is cardiovascular disease, and this study was not geared to pick that up. These patients were at low risk. Okay, so that's the T trials. Now, to summarize the main points, testosterone doesn't seem to impact on vitality or physical functioning. Or if it does, at best it does so in about 1 in every 10 to 15 people treated with testosterone. It improves sexual functioning, but probably nowhere near as good as other treatments we have, like phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitors. Testosterone treatment may improve hemoglobin in anemic older men who have low testosterone with a number needed to treat of 3. It improves bone mineral density, but there is no evidence that it reduces fractures. It doesn't improve cognition in those with memory impairment, and it increases the amount of calcium in people's coronary arteries. Now, I should also remind everyone that only 1.5% of those who were screened for this trial actually met the criteria. So this is a very strictly selected population, and we need to think about how generalizable this will be to our elderly men with low T. All right, that's it from me. Next week, I want to delve into ezetimibe. There's no doubt it lowers cholesterol, but there is a lot of doubt as to whether it actually reduces cardiovascular disease. And remember, that's why we actually care about cholesterol. So next week, we'll tackle the IMPROVE-IT trial, which was the big 7-year trial done by the manufacturers of ezetimibe that tried to prove to the world that it was an effective drug. That's next week. I'm Daniel Aronoff. I'll talk to you then.